There's a Chinese proverb that says, "We can always fool a foreigner." Writer Paul Theroux took that as a personal challenge during his recent year-long train trip through China. That journey is the subject of his new book, Riding the Iron Rooster. Theroux is a highly regarded travel writer who has chronicled his journeys to places as remote as the southernmost point of South America and as close to home as the New York subway system. His first travel book, The Great Railway Bazaar, was a bestseller. Theroux is also a novelist. Two of his novels, St. Jack and The Mosquito Coast, have been adapted into movies. When he's not traveling, Theroux divides his time between homes in England and Cape Cod. He's American-born. In his new book, Theroux explains that he decided to go by train from London to China. He thought it would be relaxing. It wasn't. But he says it was his good fortune to be wrong. Being mistaken is the essence of the traveler's tale. He told me why.
Because the unexpected has to happen in order for a traveler's tale to be effective and interesting and worth telling. I think that it's only the extraordinary, the unlikely, the unexpected that's worth writing about in travel. And if you notice, all good travel books and all good trips are good because they're not what you expect. And it's the reason why there really isn't much to say about the package tour, or if I had simply gone to the Great Wall, to Peking, Shanghai, and Canton, there really wouldn't have been a book about China that was possible. It was only because I went, I suppose, to extremes and went to such a lot of trouble to inconvenience myself that there was something worth telling.
So is that part of what makes a travel book good, too, that the traveler puts themselves through extremes?
I think that you have to offer yourself to conditions. You might travel with a theme, but there are a lot of things that can happen. The main thing is that with travel, travel writing is a very debased form, and it's a very, very insufficient form, so that travel writing can be autobiography, or it can be like a geography book, or it could be somewhere in the middle where you're writing a little bit about yourself and about other people. I think basically travel writing, it should be about other people, but inevitably autobiography gets into it.
Why did you want to return to China?
I wanted to go back because I felt that China was changing, and all countries that are in a process of change, transition, or any alteration, for example, when there's a coup d'etat, or when there's a presidential election, or when something goes badly wrong, or when they strike oil, then countries become interesting to write about. I mean, I don't find countries particularly interesting when they're moribund and changeless. But when there are events, great events, public events, let's say, then they become interesting. I wrote about England during the Falklands War, and I couldn't have chosen a better time. I mean, it was accidental, but it was the best time to write about England. I was in Argentina during the time of the colonels. That was interesting. China after Mao. And now, with the Chinese admitting that Mao is rather ambiguous and unpleasant figure for part of his life, has made the China interesting. And also, the Chinese are very candid. They're outward looking now. Their economy has changed, and I mean, nothing is more interesting than to travel sort of far and or to range far and wide in a place where these things are happening. Then you have a real subject.
Did you run into a lot of other writers with the same idea, that this is like the perfect time to catch up on what's happening in China?
I didn't run into any writers. I didn't meet people who were traveling for the purposes of writing. There are a lot of books about China, but they tend to be political books or analytical books or journeys of self-discovery. I wanted to write a book about what China looks like, what it smells like, what the food's like, what the landscape's like, the physical China, not political China. But inevitably, I mean, some politics gets into it. But I don't think of my book as political in any sense.
One of your goals was to get to China without leaving the ground, to go from England to China without leaving the ground.
Yeah.
Is that because you wanted to do something challenging or because you really don't like planes?
I don't particularly. There's nothing to like in planes. I mean, there's a lot to dislike, but a plane is really just sort of time travel. You get in, you strap yourself in, you go, and there's nothing interesting about it. I mean, compare flying to China, which takes about, let's say it takes 15 hours from London to Peking. Compare that with a month overland by train, where you go to Paris, Berlin, East and West Berlin, Warsaw, Moscow, and then along the Trans-Siberian, through Siberia, and then through Mongolia. I mean, after that, at the end of it, China, you've arrived at the end of this long trip and have seen a lot, and have seen Asia begin and Asia continue, and then China begin. It's not like plunging in the middle of China and then, you know, from Long Island or Philadelphia, and then sort of that travelogue starting. This is China arriving, or Asia beginning by degrees. And that's the way to understand a country, because a country doesn't begin abruptly at its border. It spills over its border, it spills over its frontier. And there's a lot of China in Mongolia. There's a lot of China, or let's say Asia, in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is an Asian country, or at least half of it is. So it was worth it going by overland. And that's the way the Chinese travel. So, I mean, when the Chinese leave China, they try to take the train to Paris.
You've certainly been on a lot of very long train rides in your time. One thing I like about trains is that life is on hold in a way. You can't get any phone calls. There's no big decisions to make. You're on the train reading a book or talking to people, eating, whatever. Do you like train rides? And if so, what do you like about them?
I think that I like them in countries where people travel by train. I don't think I'd enjoy being in a country... Well, say, I have mixed feelings about traveling by train in the States. I do it, and the Northeast Corridor, it's a quick way of getting from place to place, and a lot of people do it. But you don't understand the United States by taking trains. I think in countries like India, the Soviet Union, and China, and even places like Holland, where there are a lot of trains, you are traveling the way the people in the country are traveling, and seeing it with them, and... watching them at work, or you say that life is on hold. I don't think life is on hold on a train.
On an Amtrak it is.
On an Amtrak. But in most countries, life continues on a train the way it was, let's say, at their houses. I mean, people take food on, they take their children, they eat, they sleep, they make love, they have arguments, they live, they die. I mean, I was on a train in the Soviet Union where a man died. People presumably have given birth on trains. Life isn't on hold. Mm-hmm. And you're sleeping horizontally. You're walking around. There's a dining car. It's more like an ocean liner. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that it's divorced. It seems to be divorced from the life of the land. But also life continues. And one of its pleasures is that life continues. I think life is on hold in a plane where you're simply holding your breath and waiting to arrive and waiting for... the travel to begin. And inevitably, people have to do that to get places. I mean, I travel by plane all the time. I don't cross the Atlantic in a boat. But I think the train is a very revealing way of going about it. And traveling in China by train, probably the most revealing way of all, of going from place to place. Also, the Chinese don't check on train travelers the way they check on other people. If you go to an airport, I mean, they expect foreigners will be going into airports and going through customs and showing visas and passports and so forth. But slipping on and off a train is a very, very good anonymous way of rambling around China without being checked up on.
My guest is writer Paul Theroux, who's written several novels and many travel books as well. His new book is titled Riding the Iron Rooster, and it's about his train journey through China. Now, to get to China by train, you ended up signing yourself onto one of these package tours where you travel with a group of people. And this is a very unusual thing for you to do. You're usually the lonesome traveler going by yourself someplace.
Yes.
And you seemed very unhappy traveling with a group of people who felt to you like distant relatives to whom you had very little to say. Why did you do it?
I wanted to see... I wasn't very unhappy. I was... I couldn't be myself. That's a problem, you know, of being... I had to be a quiet and unassuming little person and watching. And I found that... I'm not. I'm a talkative and rather gregarious person.
You didn't have to do that. No one was forcing you to do that. I mean,
well,
to be unassuming and quiet.
I wanted to listen. I wanted to hear what people were saying. I wanted them to do the talking. And, I mean, inevitably that happens in travel, but these were all English-speaking people. And so, also, they expect you to come clean and to tell you about themselves. And as soon as a writer starts talking, or, well, when he says that he is a writer, then suddenly the conversation becomes, I mean, it turns over to him or to her, and that's the, and then people are just asking questions. Have your books been made into movies? What's it like to write? Do you write with a pencil? And you might be in an interesting place like Siberia, or they might have had interesting experience, and suddenly they're not interesting. You're interesting. And I know that other people are much more interesting than I am. I also went on this tour because I wanted to know who's going to China these days. Why are they going? Where are they coming from? What are they going to do there? What do they expect it to be? What's their reaction to Poland? What's their reaction to the Soviet Union? I mean, Americans are so paranoid about the Soviet Union. They're so pathetically sort of affectionate about the Poles. They're so fearful of, say, the East Germans. They feel so sort of inferior, let's say, to the French. I mean, the French are just the French, and the Poles are just the Poles. But we have these national prejudices against countries which have been, I suppose, foisted upon us by newspapers or by movies or something. And I was interested to see people's reactions, and then also to see, I mean, it's amazing with a Chinese smile at the traveler, how people melt, and they say, my God, they're smiling, and the streets are so clean. The simplest reactions can, or the simplest gestures can provoke reactions. Now, that's for if you're going to China with a group of people, all of those things are interesting. I learned a lot of things that I didn't know before. I mean, I didn't know that people went on package tours for shopping.
Right, yeah, you said that's what Americans do when they travel, they just shop.
A lot of people go, I mean, not just Americans, but they go to China to shop, yeah. They go to Hong Kong to shop.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting? You said that on the train rides that a lot of the people on the tour spoke to each other like they were hospital patients.
Yeah, that's true. That's well, people who are enclosed start asking each other about, you know, have you had a good night's sleep? And did you eat much? And I didn't have much for breakfast. And are you feeling all right? Well, I got a little back problem. And yes, but I seem to be, you know, my stomach's okay again today. And they are, they're sort of creaking around. But these are people, you know, middle-aged people who aren't at death's door. But they start, yeah, well, when you're alone in an enclosed space, you start thinking about your health. Am I dying? Am I sick? Am I healthy? And people on package tours are always asking, am I healthy? Have I got hepatitis? Am I going to get, you know, Montezuma's revenge or whatever? And so, yeah, that's pretty interesting, or boring as the case may be.
Well, once you got to China and you were off the package tour, you ended up eventually being assigned a traveling companion. How did that happen? And who assigned the companion to you?
Well, the Chinese got wind of the fact that I was a writer, and then began saying that they wanted to give me VIP treatment. I said I didn't really want it, but they insisted, such is their fear that you might misunderstand something, that I travel with a man. I said, yes, I'll travel with him, but I don't want to sit with him. I don't want to give him English lessons. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to eat with him. But I'll travel. I said, if he travels on a different part of the train. And he said, well, he'll carry your bags. I said, here's this Mr. Fang. He's got a father of two. He went to a university. Why do you want him to carry my bags? This is ridiculous. You know, he's a member of the proletariat. So am I. Why should he be carrying? So they got the point, actually. Inevitably, I grew to like this man very much. And he told me about his sufferings in the Cultural Revolution. He was a Russian scholar. They sent me with a person who didn't speak English because I said, well, I'm not going to talk to him, so it doesn't matter whether he speaks English or not. But we did converse in China. I speak Chinese, so that wasn't much of a problem. And I got to like him. But I didn't travel with him the whole time. After a month or so, I found a way of giving him the slip. and I was just as happy. And he went back thinking that I wasn't in China anymore. And then I was on my own.
You noticed a lot of changes in China from your previous trip. What about the way you were treated? Were you reacted to differently this time around than you were in 1980 when you first went to China?
Yes, I was, but not because of, you know, I'm a bespectacled American asking a lot of questions. I think it was mainly to do with the Chinese. I mean, I hadn't changed. They had, though.
That's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah, that they had felt a lot less pressure to conceal things. Mm-hmm. The Chinese have started to become very honest about the past, the recent past, and particularly about the Cultural Revolution, or about Chairman Mao, or about Lin Biao and what they call the Gang of Four. And they're starting to tell, well, I don't know, I suppose starting to tell the truth. Before, they were avoiding a subject. If you said Chairman Mao was a great man, they'd say, ah, interesting, you think so, huh? You think so. They never said, no, we don't think he's great, or yes, he did a lot of great things, but it made a lot of mistakes. Now they say, yes, he was great up to 1957. Then he began to have witch hunts. Then he provoked the worst and most disastrous and catastrophic 10 years that the Chinese have had to endure in their history, the Cultural Revolution, and we won't forgive him for that. But they talk to strangers. They tell the truth. And, you know, it's officially forbidden for the Chinese to talk to strangers. This is why people have guides. The Chinese are not supposed to, and you're not supposed to talk to the Chinese, you know, impromptu. Just stop someone on the street and say, and hold a conversation. It's forbidden. Mm-hmm. It's just one of the rules, like a religious person cannot be a member of the Communist Party, or in the marriage law it says you must not kill your children. And talking to foreigners is just something that's not done. But they do it.
Well, I want to talk with you more about China and about travel. But first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer Paul Theroux, whose new book is titled Riding the Iron Rooster by Train Through China. This is Fresh Air. Paul Theroux is my guest. You know, your trip through China ended in Tibet, or at least that's where your book ends up. And your book ends with you thinking how much you'd like to eventually get back to Tibet. It's interesting to me that in most travel books, I think, no matter how arduous the journey, no matter how many unexpected complexities and difficulties arise, that frequently the book ends with, gosh, I can't wait to get back. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, but there are plenty of books that aren't like that.
Well, of yours, for instance, like the Old Patagonia, the Old Patagonian Express.
Yes, I was quite eager to go back. There is a book called The Worst Journey in the World by Apsley Cherry Garrard, where he said I wouldn't go back if, you know, wild horses couldn't get me back to the South Pole, where he almost died. Wilfred Thesiger's books are not about wanting to go back. But I really did and do want to go back to the parts of China that I liked, and to a couple of parts that I wasn't able to go. I mean, some places are off limits. But Tibet was one of them. The Qinghai Desert and Amdo and Tibet, and particularly Western Tibet. I think that I've never seen a place more beautiful, more unexpected, or harder to find comparison with in the rest of the world. The air is different, the light's different. Even the mountains, I mean, they're not just the bare, craggy peaks that you see in the Alps or the Rockies or the Andes. It's a totally different place. An early traveler to Tibet, Sven Hayden, burst into tears when he first saw the mountains. And I didn't, but I can understand how he felt. How, looking at the place, you just see nothing like it on Earth. And it's a place apart.
When your trip ends, and you realize I've come to the destination that I've planned, do you try to get home as quickly as possible? Like, take that plane instead of taking the long, you know, slowly unfolding train journey back?
No, I hurry home when a trip is over. But for lots of reasons. I mean, I have a wife and two children. I have bills to pay. I have, you know, things. My life is sort of on hold in a way if I'm traveling. Imagine not getting your mail for 3, 4, 5, or 6 months, and the amount of pestering letters or demands or unanswered questions there are. You really have to go back. I find I have to go back quickly. So I think, go slowly, come back quickly. It's like a dance step, isn't it? Like a tango or something. But that's what I do. And when I left China, I went to Tibet very slowly. I took the train from Xi'an to Xining, and then Xining to Golmud in the middle of Qinghai province, which is a very, very empty province. It's a prison province where they send, it's a sort of Siberia where they send really, you know, political prisoners. And they, throughout Chinese history, they've exiled people there. So it's really at the back of beyond. Then I went by road. I rented a car and a driver, and then the driver got us into an accident, so I ended up driving to Lhasa. But that was a very slow, long, interesting trip. But I remember when I left Lhasa, I went straight home. I flew to Hong Kong and went straight back.
Have you ever gone back to the place where you grew up? And I'm not sure where that is.
I grew up in Medford, Massachusetts.
Okay, have you ever gone back there with the eye of a travel writer to look at the place with fresh eyes as if you'd never seen it before?
Yes, I've even written about it. Oh. I wrote a piece I wrote a, there's a book called that I wrote, a book of essays called Sunrise with Sea Monsters. It's 50 essays, and one of those is called Traveling Home, and it's about my high school reunion, where I went back to the town that I grew up in, Medford, Mass., and went back to my 20th high school reunion, which was one of the most interesting experiences of travel, and also of traveling through time as well as in space, of going back and seeing these people. I did it earlier this year, in going back to the place that I was in the Peace Corps with 25 years ago. In 63, I went to Nyasaland, which later became Malawi. I was in the Peace Corps. And I went back to my old school there. I'm going to make another visit, and then I'm going to write about it. But that also was, I mean, going back is a wonderful thing, but you have to leave a lot of time, 10, 15, 20, ideally 20 years, I think. But 25 years in the case of Malawi was amazing. And I think that it will be enjoyable to write about, but it's difficult to write about because you're writing about looking down the years as well as sort of looking at a particular place. And in the case of Africa, I mean, so much has happened, well, and also a great deal hasn't happened.
Since you brought up your Peace Corps experience, I was, you know, reading about that and read somewhere that the first time you heard a Beatles record, it was in a bar in Africa.
And yeah, that's a fact.
And it made me think about how, since you started traveling when you were so young, that you experienced some of the big cultural landmarks of your generation away from home and away from other people from your culture.
Yes, I mean, the first marijuana I smoked was also in the Peace Corps in Malawi. First Beatles, first marijuana, and I got married actually in Uganda. I mean, my wife is English, so a lot of things happened to me. I mean, as a result of leaving home, I had felt all my life, all my early life, that nothing would have happened to me if I didn't leave home, and that it was necessary for me to go very, very far away for me to realize what I wanted to be. And I mean, I think I was right. If I had stayed in Medford, it would have been very much more difficult to become a writer, because people didn't become writers in Medford. They stayed in Medford and did other things. But in order to be myself, I had to go quite far. Joining the Peace Corps was only one of the strategies that I had, but there were others.
Well, no, did you have to get far away from home because other people, like you said, didn't become writers there, or because you felt that other people, your family and friends, wouldn't let you become who you wanted to be?
Well, I think it's partly that, but you can't really blame other people. I think it was my fault that I didn't have the courage, because at the age of 18 or 19, it's hard to have the courage to say, I want to be a writer, or I'm going to be a writer, because the proof is like saying, I want to be a dancer or an actor or a movie director. There are certain things that you can't say to people. You can't say, I'm going to be, I mean, you can't say, I'm going to be a radio presenter or a radio broadcaster, can you? Because where's your radio? Where's your microphone? In the case of a writer, they'd say, well, what are you going to write? People, I mean, I must have tried the question on people. I was very shy about admitting that I wanted to be a writer. And it was only through travel that I was able to see, to tell perfect strangers that I wanted to be a writer, and they'd say, oh yes, because some people understood that. And then it seemed that as if I had something to write about. But, I mean, I'm not blaming the people in Medford, Mass., but it's, growing up is very, very difficult, but I think you become extremely self-conscious, and the convention at the time was that people became dentists, doctors, lawyers, or they went to Vietnam and got killed, which was another alternative that I was trying to avoid.
Since you've traveled to so many places, does home ever seem like an arbitrary decision? Like, why am I living here as opposed to another country or as opposed to another block or another city?
No, oddly enough, I really feel that I belong to the eastern part of Massachusetts. And, I mean, I live on Cape Cod for about half the year. It's something that what you just said is something I've never felt. I've never felt that I could attach myself to another culture or another country. I've lived in England for quite a long time. I feel like a total alien there. And it surprises me that Japanese, Nigerians, Hindus, Pakistanis, Afghans, Russians come to the United States and say, I'm an American. How can people do that? I mean, they're leaving so much behind. I know that there's a necessity, or in history there's been a necessity for people to do that. But they must have this tremendous longing to go back at times. They must have a homing instinct. There must be like, I mean, I think of all new Americans as homesick people. Or maybe they're like people who are drowning, who are in a kind of lifeboat, and the lifeboat's flying the stars and stripes, but still they're leaving something behind. And it's something that I could never do, perhaps because I'm an American, and Americans don't transplant very easily. You don't find Americans who become Indians. The Japanese forbid anybody, any foreigner, from becoming Japanese. So other people don't do it. But in other words, I have a very strong sense of home, and I think it's a strong sense of home that makes me a traveler. So I have a place to go back to. It's people who don't have a place to go back to who are aimless, and I think not particularly good travelers, because they're always looking for something to attach themselves to. They're looking for a country, a great good place, or somewhere to live. I'm not looking for a place to live. I'm just looking. And I think we're in a kind of impartial way.
Now that you've returned from a trip, are you planning another?
No, I'm writing a novel at the moment, and I think I'll... And I've been writing movie scripts with a lot of pleasure. So I'll wait a while. I think travel is an indulgence. I mean, it takes so long. It's a lot of trouble. Your family, my family misses me. I miss them. So I think I'll wait a while, maybe 2 or 3 years. And then there are a lot of parts of the world that I've never been. Then I'll probably pick up and do it. But the best travel is not writing about it. It's actually going to a place and going for a hike, going camping. Or in my case, I like kayaking, so I'd do something like that, I suppose.
This is what we civilians call a vacation.
Oh, I'm very fond of the phrase that psychologists use, deep play.
Right.
Where the risks far outweigh the gains.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
My guest has been writer Paul Theroux, and his new book is titled Riding the Iron Rooster by Train Through China. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.